Blog Talk Radio.
I got ice in my veins, blood in my eyes, hate in my heart, love in my mind. I seen nights full of pain, days are the same. You keep the sunshine, save me the rain. I search but never find, hurt but never cry. I work and forever try, but I'm cursed, so never mind. And it's worse, but better times seem further and beyond. The top gets higher, the more that I climb. The spot gets smaller, and I get bigger. Trying to get in where I fit in. No room for a nigga, but soon for a nigga. It be on, motherfucker, cause all this bullshit, it made me strong, motherfucker. So I pick the world up and I'ma drop it on your fucking head. Yeah, bitch, I'ma pick the world up and I'ma drop it on your fucking head. Yeah, and I could die now, rebirth, motherfucker. Hop up in my spaceship and leave Earth, motherfucker. I'm gone.
No,
motherfucker, I'm gone.
What is up? Detroit Sports Rag Podcast for Monday, March 9th, 2015 on the air. Jeff Moss joined on the other end of the line by the Detroit Sports Rag's number two in command. You know him as at Darko State News, Justin Spiro. Hello.
Good evening, Jeffrey. How are you?
Well, I'm doing a lot better than you because I think about 15 years older than you, which means I have 15 years more seniority when it comes to following the Detroit Lions, which means I don't care anymore, while you still do. So while I'm reveling in the Detroit Lions' latest failure, latest complete and utter fuck-up, I hear you're a little depressed about Ndamukong Suh leaving Detroit for Miami tomorrow.
Yes, and it's something I've sort of come to terms with over the course of the last couple of weeks, going over everything and sort of realizing the corner that the Lions have painted themselves into. I posted on the DSR message board a few days ago just saying that there was no good option here, that extending Ndamukong Suh at the number that it was required to would mean the Lions could not be competitive going forward. And I don't think they can be competitive with him or without him at this point. So I think it's really looking back at the restructurings, and that's what we're going to get into, I'm sure, a little bit later. But, yeah, at the end of the day, when you lose what has been the second-best player in franchise history, in my opinion, certainly the best on the defensive side of the ball, it is devastating. So regardless of what the numbers look like and what the salary implications are, it just sucks to lose a guy that impactful. And frankly, one of the few defensive linemen in my football watching history that has been fun to watch. I mean, it's not terribly common that you pay too much attention to a defensive tackle when you're watching on television, but Suh was that type of talent. So anytime generational talent like that walks out the door, it's a tough day in Darko newsland.
Well, let's set the table. What we're going to discuss tonight, we're going to talk about Suh going to Miami, which will become official tomorrow, obviously. there will be no last-minute reprieve.
There's still hope, according to a few people.
Yeah, right. Who is that, Tom Mazzaway?
Mike O'Hara.
Come on, he said there was still hope?
He backed off it, but he had a tweet when it first came out that the Lions were not out of it.
Of course, if you don't know who Mike O'Hara is, longtime Detroit News Lions beat writer who sold his soul to the devil to cover the Lions for DetroitLions.com, which is kind of a nice segue to who our first guest is. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say his name, but I do have to get him on the line here in a second. But we're going to talk to a guest who used to work for the Lions, who's going to give us a little bit of a national perspective on what happened here. And he's got some pretty interesting take on where the Lions really screwed up, and he basically thinks they could have rectified this as late as this week. And I purposely didn't tell you about what his opinion of this was, but we'll get him on in a second. I also want to touch base with you regarding Mitch Albom's article that he wrote about Sue leaving, because I think you had a brilliant take on that, and I think we should discuss that. And we're, what, 13 days away from the DSR Fantasy Baseball League and the unveiling of the higher power?
The higher power, yes.
The higher power. I think we definitely need to talk about that, which will also be something we can discuss with our guest, because our guest is also a fantasy sports-like writer. So it really works out well. Let's see. Call. I'm trying to get this through. We need some, like, music to go along with the dialing.
Well, if you didn't fire our producer a couple weeks back, this wouldn't be a problem.
That's true. Well, why don't you explain why we fired the producer?
I think we already explained it on the last podcast. We had set up on a Sunday to do a podcast that would be our first ever professionally produced podcast with drops and lead-in music, other than just you randomly pressing play on your iTunes. And the guy flaked out at the last second, Matthew Milko. And every couple of days I tweet at him asking if he has any, if he knows any professional producers that want to work with us just to fuck with him. And he takes the bait every time. He always responds that we got to work with him or it's no one and we're screwed without him. And so I don't know. I mean, I think eventually when I move back to Michigan in 5-ish months, when we get our little studio rolling, we're gonna be doing a quite bit better.
5-ish months? What the? I thought you're moving back in August.
At the end of August, yep.
What the hell? Aren't you done with school like soon?
I'm taking a couple summer classes and we'll be done then.
All right. Well, we got our guests. We can talk about your 7-year law school program later, but mystery guest, are we allowed to say who you are and what your name is?
Yes, you are. Yes, you are.
Oh, okay. On the other end of this line is Jay Clemens, who is an Atlanta-based writer for Fox Sports, a Michigan native, used to live in Detroit, and used to be an employee of the Detroit Lions. And not only that, if I'm not mistaken, you were the first Tim 20-man, right?
Yes, I was. Actually, there was somebody there before me. So I don't know who that person was, but I believe I was the second version of Tim 20-man.
So you used to work for DetroitLions.com, basically. You were the lead writer?
Yeah. It was a primitive job in terms of we didn't shoot a lot of videos or podcasts or anything, but it was a good job, and the thing about the job that I love is that I had autonomy. Like, I didn't have to deal with a lot of people in front of me, like department heads, but they quickly took care of that once I moved on.
So when you started at DetroitLions.com, what was it, like, 2002 or 2003 or something like that?
No, 2004 and 05, yep.
2004 and 05. Who would you have been directly reporting to at that point?
Well, Brian Bender was my first boss, and him and I are still tight. He's a great guy. Had all the respect for him. And then I moved over to Matt Barnhart. That was a tricky thing. But Barnhart and I, once I was done working there, him and I are fine. So, I see every time the Lions play the Falcons, I go there, and I would have gone to the game this year had it not been played in London. But, you know, I'm good with everybody there. It was an odd experience because very uncomfortable working for a team where you have to basically be, you know, you have to kind of toe in line with the company line. And it's an awkward thing to do, but I was able to just get through it and move on.
Well, not only were you the team's propagandist, it was the worst time probably in the history of the team. I mean, you were right there smack dab in the middle of the Matt Millen mayhem.
Well, okay, let's be fair about this, okay? I liked Matt Millen, okay? I think he got kind of a bad rap in terms of, like, his history thing. Like, if the Lions had gone 1-15 in 08, you know, John Fox went 1-15 as a coach, and no one says boo about that. George Seifert won Super Bowls, went 1-15. I think he was the coach of Carolina in 01 when they lost 15 straight or something like that. So, you know, it's bad. But the 0-16 thing was horrible. But at the same time, in a very sick, perverted way, I take almost pride in it. because if anybody could pull that off, it would be the Lions. And so, you know, you kind of have to, like, give them credit for that. They went the distance on that one. But 04-05, Milling was actually a champ because, remember, he had fleeced the Browns in Butch Davis out of a second-round pick in the 04 draft just to move down one slot. And they weren't going to take Kellen Winslow anyway. So
right.
Milling, you could make the argument when I was there that Milling was at the height of his power in terms of the people of Detroit perceiving him as like a smart guy, like in terms of a guy that could get them to like contending playoffs annually and all that stuff. Yeah.
All right, we could maybe get to some of the inner workings of working for a sports team a little later, but we had talked earlier today, and I thought you made an interesting point about how bad the Lions messed this up, and you had read my article that I posted last night regarding blaming Tom Luan and Martin Mayhew for this screw up. But you brought up an interesting point where you said that you thought the Lions could have franchised Stu as late as, you know, last week when that deadline came up, I guess what, last Monday?
Yep.
And then spent the rest of this, I don't know, next week or so trying to deal him. Can you explain what your thought process
sure.
that was?
Okay, let's jump. I'm an NFL writer, and I do fantasy football. Thanks for mentioning that. But I'm not an expert in this, but my understanding of the rules, if they had franchised him, okay, Sue could have done two options. He could have signed the tender right away and then maybe just said, okay, we're going to do it. Or he could have signed it and politely asked for a trade. Or he could have not signed it at all, knowing full well that he could always get that in his back pocket. And then the Lions could have said, okay, go negotiate a deal. Here's the deal. He's going to be 29 years old next January. Like, the Lions should have called the bluff and franchised him, knowing full well that his high-powered agent, Jimmy Sexton, would have had trouble negotiating a $100 million-plus deal for a 29-year-old defensive tackle. So that the Lions should have called the bluff. And I've yet to – I'm not calling out anybody in Detroit media individually. And I know you're disdain for a lot of people, but I've yet to see a single article on what would have happened if they had actually franchised him in terms of the collateral damage the Lions would have had to do to clear out salary for that 26.7. It's a lot, but at the same time, everyone knows it shouldn't have been 26.7 million to begin with. Like, if they had never restructured him, the deal would have been, I believe, something like 18.8 million, and that would have been an easy framework to negotiate a long-term deal, especially when J.J. Watt is 6 years, $100 million. And then Gerald McCoy, who was drafted one slot after Sue in 2010, signed a seven-year, $100 million deal with $50 million guaranteed. They could have easily worked within those parameters to make it happen. And that's what destroys me more than anything, is because I want the Lions to do well. You know, I may be objective, but at the same time, I still at the core want them to do well. And they blew their chance to have leverage, and it just blows the mind that you would screw up leverage like that. You would squander it away when you didn't really have to do that.
You got a question, Spiro?
No, not on that point. So basically your suggestion is they should have franchised him as a way of leveraging a long-term extension. Is that what you're suggesting?
No. They should have here's the deal, okay? It's the NFL. If they wanted to keep him, great. If they wanted to get something for him, I would have been fine with that too. No one man is great, and I know – I read the article last night that our great host wrote the other night, and I believe and I agree with him. But at the same time, just like the Barry thing, you know, like you got to move on from things like this. Like, you got to have a plan B, and I don't think the Lions ever had a plan B. But they could have easily called his bluff. Like, Sue has been saying all this time that he was going to let his agent pick his team. Well, if they had franchised him, knowing full well that he was going to be 29 next year, and it would have been, you know, signing a 28-year-old to a five-year deal of $100 million sounds a lot better than signing a 29-year-old, especially coming off a season where they were the number one defense. So the Lions,
you got to go another year and be healthy. I mean, he gambled the 1 year. He gambled the 1 year. Okay, you've been relatively healthy your whole career. Has he ever missed a game because of an injury? I don't think so. I think the only game he ever missed were because of the suspension.
He never missed a game due to an injury.
Right.
Never.
But you're rolling the dice every – it's one thing for Max Scherzer to take insurance out and say, I'm going to play 1 year in a non-contact sport and say, okay, I'm going to roll the dice and see if I can get more than $144 million. It seems to me, and this is why I thought – I agree with Dave Burkett of the Free Press was – like you said, call his bluff and franchise him, and then see what he's going to do. Like you said, there's a there's a the interpretation around here is that he's a lot younger than he is because he went to Nebraska and graduated.
Exactly.
You know, and he's only been around for 5 years. After Matthew Stafford's been around for 5 years, he was about, what, 26 or something? Because,
yeah,
you know, he left after a junior year and he was young for some, you know, he was younger. But, you know, Sue is getting up there for defensive tackle, and I agree. But the thing that I thought was interesting was the point about they could have worked something out with him or worked out a trade after franchising him.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Everyone assumes that he would have signed the tender. No, if he would have signed the tender, then he would have lost his leverage of demanding a trade because the team that would have traded for him would have had to forfeited would have forfeited 2 first-round picks, okay? So no one was going to do that. But if they had franchised him and didn't sign the tender and gave him a window to negotiate a deal, then the Lions would have got something back for it. Like, there's no one player in the NFL, like, is bigger than the team. And if the Lions want to move on, it's great. But instead of moving on with 2 first-round picks or somebody like that, they move on with getting a compensatory pick sometime in the second or third round of this year or next year, whenever it comes. And that's horrible.
Third round, I mean,
yeah, you're talking about an in his prime superstar. You cannot squander leverage like that. That's the only problem I have with it. If they wanted to trade him, fine. Like, I'm a little bothered that they didn't extend fairly last year. And the fact that they took Aaron Donald, I mean, they passed on Aaron Donald, just blew my mind. And if they had taken Odell Beckham, obviously in hindsight, that would have been great. But I don't want to be that person that criticizes things after the fact. But I do know that Greg Olsen is the only tight end been taken in the last 8 years in the first round that's been worth a damn. So the fact that you value a tight end spot when you know you're going to lose one or two of your best defensive linemen and you don't take a guy who was by heads and shoulders the best defensive lineman in that draft, forget about at that spot. He was the best one in that draft. The pass on him just blows the mind. And the funny thing is I saw Mayhew at the Clemson Pro Day last year, and I talked to him, and, you know, like, I know him pretty well. And I have nothing bad to say about him, but when I worked for Lions, I used to think he had the best resume of anybody I'd ever seen in terms of preparation to work in a front office, in terms of, you know, education, all that stuff. And if they were going to take Watkins, I would not have a problem with that. I just had a problem with taking a tight end because you name the top 5, top 10 tight ends in the NFL, outside of Greg Olsen, they've all been taken in round 2, 3, 4, whatever, you know.
And I think, you know, first of all, I agree with you with everything you just said, but I want to emphasize a little bit more the Fairley point, because the option, I believe, was $5.5 million. For a guy of Fairley's talent, injury prone or not, he's going to get
completely
a lot more
doable
than that on the market right now. I mean, that was a bad miscalculation. He would be a solid value at that number right now. Even if he plays 8 or 9 games up to his capability, that's worth it in the market. He's gonna blow a $5.5 million contract out of the water in free agency, especially with the dearth of talent along the defensive line. I think that is the worst point.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no problem. I think, you know, it's not one or the other. I think those are both good points. But really, I think we're all three of us are sort of looking at it thus far in a micro view. I want to prefer to take a step back and look at the macro view. The fact that this team has over $5 million more in dead money over the second worst team, which is the Baltimore Ravens, who at least cashed in the title on the way, is an embarrassment. And that is the biggest indictment on Tom Wand and Martin Mayhew. I mean, that is the number one point to me, because you know what? Star players leave, and maybe not to the extent of Sue's star power, and maybe not as poorly as this was handled. But at the end of the day, big names do change cities, and that's it happens. It's the nature of sports. But when you look at how much dead money is on this cap, you don't have dead money and no playoff wins. That is unacceptable to be this high on the list, to be so far ahead of the second-place team, which, as I stated, won a Super Bowl 2 years ago. There was no payoff for this. They took a deep, steep debt, and there was no payoff. And you know what? If you don't win the Super Bowl, that's fine. You know, that's the ultimate goal. It's very hard to win a Super Bowl. But to not even get one playoff win out of this debt crisis, it's unforgivable. I think this is the last straw with this front office. there were a lot of people giving Mayhew the benefit of the doubt. I don't think anyone's ever really liked LeWand. But there are people that still defend Mayhew. But, they, you know, I think even Moss and I were not Mayhew haters the last couple years. But I think at this point it became apparent that they should have taken the NFL's advice in doing in accepting assistance, doing a thorough search to replace the Millen regime. That was a huge mistake. And this has been completely mismanaged for all the reasons we've stated, the dead money, the poor choices and restructuring of contracts that led to that dead money, passing on Aaron Donald, which, frankly, I wasn't banging the Donald drum so much at the time. I wanted him to take a corner, but I was banging the Fairley drum at the time. That's no hindsight on my part, and I know Moss was as well. There have just been too many critical mistakes, and now where does this team go? They weren't that great to begin with. There was a lot of smoke and mirrors to get that 11-5, and you lost your most impactful player that you've had on the defensive side of the ball, maybe ever, certainly in the modern era.
Well,
Does this team go from here? It's a really bad spot they're in right now.
Before Jeff says something, and I want to hear what you guys think, but let's remember, do you remember when Schwartz was the coach, and I think they played a game against, the Saints or somebody like that, where maybe it was the Texans, it was a road game, and where Sue didn't have any tackle, or he didn't do anything, but Schwartz said that he was like the most valuable defender out there because he was creating all this havoc. There was a time when people doubted Sue in terms of his greatness. And so I have to wonder, like, how did the Lions get so good? Is it because Terrell Austin? Is it because they had savvy moves? Like, it's one of those things where I give Sue plenty of credit, but I'm not sure why he gets all the credit for them being great. Like, he was great against Dallas, but over the last 5 years, there were times when I wondered if he was, like, even playing, you know, during that game, because he was basically non-existent.
Well,
so
he's drawing double teams on every play. I mean,
sure. Three-time All-Pro, four-time Pro Bowler, not taking it away. And I know a lot of people, like I heard Bill Polian say today, that defensive tackles are the most important people because they're closest to the ball. That's fine. I had no problem with him getting money because the salary cap keeps going up. And next year when the new TV deal it comes in, it's going to explode even more. So all these teams that keep robbing Peter to pay Paul in terms of delaying the cap, they're not being penalized that much. But the dead money thing is you're completely on. They should have taken that into account. If you're going to be paying them all this dead money, you might as well assign them anyway to the franchise.
Well, here's the thing, and this is the Lions' MO since I'm going to be 43 years old this year, and I've been watching this team since I was about 5 or 6. And the one common thread to me in all those years I've been watching the team is this organization has always been run like it's a family produce business. Okay? For the first 20-some years of my life, I think until about 89 or 88, they had Russ Thomas running the organization, and there is not one person in the world who understood why Russ Thomas was the general manager of a professional football team. He wouldn't have been a GM on any other team, and if he was, he would have lasted for a year or two. He was William Clay Ford Sr.'s drinking buddy. They were pals, and that's how he got the job. Then another person who would never have got another job in any other NFL front office, Chuck Schmidt, was in charge of, you know, salary cap, negotiating, all those things. And the team basically let their coaches, Wayne Fonts and Bobby Ross, run the draft and all the player personnel. This team has never been run like a professional sports organization of any other team. Now we have Tom LeWand, who is on the website. It states that he's guiding the overall direction of this team. Tom LeWand would not be an executive in any other sport, and with his background, the guy was William Clay Ford Sr.'s attorney's son and a good pal of Bill Ford Jr. That is how you get a job with the Detroit Lions. You're either the drinking buddy of the dead owner, you're friends with the current owner. These people would not have jobs at any other sports entity. So when you wonder how it's possible, which it's almost mathematically impossible, to go 57 years and win one playoff game, I've run the math. It's like a less than 2% chance that could possibly happen based on all of the variables. Okay? It couldn't happen if you hired football people or sports people to run the organization, but they don't. They hire family friends cronies, and you know, you were inside that building. How does Tom Lawan go from, you know, being an attorney at U of M to having no sports background to running a billion-dollar sports franchise?
I can't explain that, really, and I'm not saying that in a bad way. The NFL and sports and business, sports in general, is all about networking and who you know. I'll give you a quick story. When I worked for the Lions, when I first started working there, Ricky Sandoval, who was the head of security, who is now passed on, I believe he died of cancer, leukemia,
whatever.
He was a great guy. I really enjoyed working with him. He scared the frick out of me all the time, too, because he was just a huge man, and he was the Raiders and 49ers security guys in the 80s and 90s. I was talking to him one day there when I was working there, and he was just giving me crap about whatever, and he said, look around this organization. Do you know how many people here didn't know the current administration when they got hired? And I said, no, how many? He goes, one. He goes, you are the only person in this organization that didn't know Matt Millen or the Fords before they got hired.
Let's look at the other teams in town, okay, and compare. So you got the attorney of William Clay Ford Sr.'s son is running this team, and the general manager is a guy who was second in command to the worst general manager in professional sports. That should have alone, no matter what his qualifications were, his resume, should have disqualified Martin Mayhew. You had to get a fresh start. Instead, they didn't even do an interview process, and the only reason they didn't get fined for the Rooney Rule was because Mayhew happened to be an African-American. Okay, now let's go to the Wings. The Wings groomed Ken Holland for many years. He was a scout for, I think, over a decade. He trained under Scotty Bowman. He was there with Jimmy Devolano tutoring him also. Finally, they gave him the keys to the car after, I don't know, 13 or 14 years in 97, 98. They go out and hire the best coach and one of the best coaches in hockey. Say what you want about Dombrowski. The guy had a pedigree. He had won a World Series with the Florida Marlins. The Pistons, they go out and get Stan Van Gundy. These are all people who have excelled somewhere in their sport. And to me, it's almost like they say the thing that, and this is for you, Spear, they say you want to get away with something like ludicrous, like a crime, a really insane crime. You like do the most crazy thing possible because nobody will believe it. And it's almost like that's what the Lions are. They've done something so insane by hiring cronies and buddies of the Ford family that it should almost be the lead of every single story about the Lions. That this guy, Tom Lawan Jr., is running this organization. After humiliated himself, embarrassed himself with that DUI, it sounds like he still has a drinking problem because every article about it keeps saying, you know, he's fighting this and he's struggling. It sounds like he's probably had a few relapses. These are the people running this organization, and it's really the most underreported portion of the Lions story, in my opinion.
I was interviewing right before I was fired from the DSR for the seventh time. I had a good interview with Colin Cowherd from ESPN, talked to him for about 30 minutes, and we spent maybe 15 of those minutes talking about the dysfunction of the Detroit Lions. Now, Cowherd is really well-connected with multiple league sources, has Bill Polian on all the time, as Jay mentioned earlier, he was on today. I asked Colin what was the sort of national perception of the Lions in his circles. I mean, we all know it's kind of the laughingstock organization of the league right there with the Browns. He said that he talked with a former Lions scout who he didn't name, but I guess the Lions ignore their scouting staff every year at come draft time, that there have been numerous times where he was alluding specifically to Matt Millen, where Matt Millen would veto the scouting, his scouts and the scouting reports to get the headline-grabbing pick, specifically mentioning Mike Williams. I know the general perception, and maybe Jay can touch on that because I think he was there during that time, but I know the general perception, according to Cowherd, from people he talks to in the league, is that the Fords never really cared that much about winning. It's not that they would rather lose. Obviously, no one would. They would prefer to win, but winning is just they don't crave wins the way the Patriots do or the Steelers do or the Ravens do. They want to run their family company. And the way he put it, he said they run it like a mom-and-pop pizza shop where, you know, someone gets caught stealing a couple bucks from the register. You know, they get off with a warning. If they don't bring in the most money that particular month, it'll be okay. We'll get them next time. There's no cutthroat nature to the organization. And I thought it's nothing that we wouldn't have probably guessed already, but he basically confirmed what I suspected, that in circles, privately, high up in the NFL, the Fords are respected as a good family, good people, but really buffoonish owners that have no desire to achieve at the highest level. And he said,
Jake,
as long as the Fords own the team, the Lions will never win a Super Bowl.
Jake, can you name me another team in the history of sports where the league tried to step in and intercede on?
I'm sure there's plenty of examples. You know, but
name one where the league said, we want to help you hire the next person to run your organization. It's almost, please name one. I've racked my brain for many years over this. I can't think of any where the league has to step in. These people are billionaires. Every team in professional sports is owned by a billionaire, someone who usually had some success in some point of life, someone in the family. Obviously, Bill Ford Sr. was, you know, he inherited all his money, and he never really did anything to earn it at Ford Motor Company. And, you know, this is what happens. But I can't think of any other similar situation.
Jay, you sounded like you wanted to cut in on the Mike Williams thing.
Yeah.
Do you have any insight into that?
05, I'm working for them, and I'm the web guy, but I was always bugging Russ Bollinger, who now works for the Falcons, incidentally, because my office was right next to the studio. If you guys have ever been there, you know where they have the big
studio. No, I've never been there.
Right.
They tried to get me arrested. I'm not allowed inside Allen Park. The city, not the building.
I forgot about that. That's right. Anyway, my office was right next to the studio. And so a lot of people, in the NFL, they're working 100 hours, you know, whatever a week. And so the kids would always come to the facility because that's the only time the parents would see them. And kids would come to my area because it was an open area and I had a basketball to hoop. And so I would basically do all the stuff. And so I would tell Russ Bollinger all the time, like, if I can help you in any way, just let me know. And so they gave me a job on the side of cataloging mock drafts in terms of giving them spreadsheets on who was going to go where and all that stuff. And they were picking 10, I want to say, that year. And on the day before the draft.
Wait, they had you like looking to see what Mel Kiper and those people were?
Well, yeah. And I would do spreadsheets. Like, this is 05. It was still kind of primitive of where they eat. Like, pro football talk was only a year old, I want to say. And so everything was still kind of primitive in terms of, like, trying to gauge what the outsiders were thinking. And so I came back to them on the Friday, and I sent them reports every week. And I was happy to do it for free, and I loved every second of it. And Bollinger asked me the day before the draft, he said, okay, who do you think we should take at 10? And I said, this is a defense-heavy draft. You can't go wrong with DeMarcus Ware, Antrell Roll, or Derek Johnson, who was a linebacker for the Chiefs. Said, you can't go wrong. And he just looked at me and he goes, going defense. And that was my first clue that everything I had given him didn't really matter. So it was weird. It was he said it sincerely, but at the same time, it was just an awkward thing. You know?
No, I think that's, you know, anecdotal example of really the bigger picture of what we're talking about. And, again, I don't have any inside sources within Allen Park, but just based on the discussion with Coward, they don't listen to their scouts. It is run on, let's grab the headlines. What's going to, yeah, similar to what the Jets do. You know, they're going to try to win the press conference. They're going to try to win the front page while the Giants just don't give a crap and keep winning Super Bowls.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you believe in 02 that they wanted to take Quentin Jammer, but the ownership or whoever pressured them to take Joey Harrington? If you believe that to be true, then that has merit. But it's one of those things where...
Is it even a question of believing? I thought that was common. I thought that was pretty much commonly accepted that that's exactly what happened in 2002.
Just, you know, it was one of those things because, you know, they could have drafted Aaron Rodgers at number 10 in 05, but at the time, Harrington was still showing promise. You know, it's one of those things where it just drives you crazy. A lot of NFL teams make mistakes, okay? And the draft is not a perfect science. I realize that. And in fact, if you look at the Lions last... I'm looking at a list. I made up a list. 6, 10 picks in the round 2. The last 10 picks in round 2 alone it's amazing that they were finished 11-5 this year. You know, if you think about it, it's sometimes they really impress me because they have some savvy moves, especially infrastructure. I think they've done a good job with infrastructure in the last few years in terms of offensive, defensive line. But they've had some horrible luck, you know, in the round two. It's amazing that they're this good, which brings me to what Jeff wrote about yesterday. The fact that they could go 5-11 next year is not out of the question, and that's what drives me crazy about any NFL team. The worst thing you can do to your fans is go 10-11 wins 1 year and then fall back to the pack the next year. I would rather go 6-8 and then all of a sudden be 12 and be that 12-win team for 5 years. You know, everything else.
When did the Lions ever really put back-to-back seasons together?
Well, I wrote about it this year.
Even Barry's years, they were every other year. It was in and out.
Don't quote me on this, but I wrote about it during the playoffs. I'm pretty sure they've never had double-digit wins seasons in back-to-back years. So it is.
I'm pretty sure that's correct.
They haven't in my lifetime. I know that.
And you know, the funny thing is, Jeff, we're not that far away. I am 1 year behind you. So the 83 loss to the 49ers still sticks to me every day of my life because, to me, that was the closest we've come to anything. Like, 91 was great beating Dallas, but I didn't think Dallas was a good team. I figured they were a year away, and I was, you know, correct. And I knew they'd get killed against Washington, but 83,
yeah, well,
I literally thought they had
already got, they'd already got killed by, what, 30-some points, 40-some
yeah.
points that year at Washington, I think, in the first game.
Yeah,
of the season.
Open week, yeah.
Yeah.
No,
we didn't have any hope.
They had a chance. I thought 83
never
had
any hope.
Too. 83
you know
was
what
the closest
that no, you know what I thought the best team that they had was? Where I actually kind of, for a few moments, actually convinced myself that they might do something.
93.
It was the year that Fonz was going to get fired, and they went on, that 8-game winning streak and made the playoffs.
That was 95. They were 3-6. They ended up beating San Fran on a Monday Night Football when they were 0-3 and turned it around. I believe they went 10-6. That's the year that Barry got booted from the SI cover because of something famous. I forget, Pete Rose did something. It was something like that. But that was a great year. And then they end up losing to Philly.
They were favored in that game. They were the favorite, like
Lomas
by 4.5 points.
Lomas guaranteed the win. That is the most – I hate to be this person because I've grown up now. I'm an objective reporter. But the cockiest I've ever been as a Lions fan in my life was that game. I believe it was New Year's Eve of 1995 against the Phillies. I was so cocky going into it. You know?
Yeah, and it was like 28-0 in the first quarter.
Yeah.
I mean, they just got – I mean, if anything – you could say so many things. I mean, this I listed off the litany of things that we've suffered through just in my lifetime as a Lions fan. And it's – you know, any two or three of those things for any other organization, you wouldn't even believe it. The fact that you get up to, 10, if the Red Wings drafted a guy in the top 10 and the second year he was a pro, he killed three kids or teenagers in a car accident, you'd, still be talking about that to this day. It'd be, something that was mentioned, once a week. Nobody ever even mentions Reggie Rogers because there's been, 17 calamities since then.
Eric Andelsek got killed, I believe, on my birthday of 92. I mean, there's no explanation.
Mowing his lawn.
Yeah, he was planting something. He was doing something like that. But that,
yeah.
I mean, you can't write that stuff. And I'm not trying to be – and you and I obviously have different writing styles. But the way I look at it, they spend money. No one's ever questioned that. It's just that they don't – if you want to say they don't know
money after Russ
fine.
Thomas left. But the first 20 years of my life, they penny-pinched every draft pick, went through an ugly holdout. It was terrible up until Thomas finally left, and once I think Chuck Schmidt took over, that stopped. But let's not say that they were always spendthrifts.
Okay,
you know,
fine.
They were ridiculous until I turned about 20-21. Half my life they were an embarrassment in that department.
You remember when the USFL signed Billy Sims to a contract after the Lions had already signed him?
Yeah, I think I cried.
That was. And the funny thing is, Billy had hurt his knee, and kind of wondered what he would have been like had he been running on steel turf or something like that. And it's one of those things where they're just if you want, and I'm not trying to be mean here, but if you honestly say they don't know how to win, that's incredibly imbalanced. They don't know what they're doing in terms of long-term success. And I'm trying to be fair and even-handed about it, but you can't go through a run like this for the last 57 years. It's incredibly hard to fail like this the way they've done.
Jay, I want to ask you, one of the things we haven't even touched on yet is the hubris shown by Tom Juan and Martin Mayhew regarding their prospects of re-signing Sue. This has been dating back almost 15 months now, where they continuously to the media said, you know, we're confident that we're going to get a deal done. We believe he wants to be here. We want him here. There was a very sort of shut the hell up attitude towards anyone who proposed the idea that Sue might bolt after 2014. Do you think that it's boiled down to two options? They were either completely fooled and misjudged the whole situation, or they were just lying to the media about their confidence level. Which do you think it is?
I think, as Grandpa Simpson would say, it's a little from column A, a little from column B. And here's the thing. You know the line from Stripes where Bill Murray is giving some speech and Sergeant Hulka just, like, interrupts him and just starts laughing and goes, okay, tough guy, we'll see how you do? That's how I felt, Jerry, because they're talking and you almost want to feel like Hulka calling them on their on whatever they're saying, knowing full well when they pass on the franchise tag, all the leverage goes to Jimmy Sexton and Sue. And that's just amazing. Like, you can't – there's no point in telling the media – what the fans want to hear if you have no interest in actually backing it up.
Well, the DSR has considered Sue's exit to be pretty much a foregone conclusion for a long time now. So I know we never thought it.
When I did the hearing-impaired version of the webcast last year with Katzenstein, Burkett, and Mikey, they were all, you know, well, they all thought that there was still a chance. And I was like, what are you talking about? Why the hell would the guy not sign a contract now? Why would he play it out and then stay with the Lions? I mean, it seemed like it was completely obvious that this guy was going to bolt if he had the chance. And if they were telling LeJuan and Mayhew, oh, we're going to stay or this and that, it was probably only so they wouldn't franchise him. It's almost like they just slow played him, and these two, really. Not since the blind owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers got, you know, submarined by, well, what's Boozer. Have we seen anything as inept as what Mayhew and Luan have done? In every single sign. His freaking sister tweeted out 2.5 years ago, freedom in 2.5 years, and almost to the date was the day that the guy left. Now, I did hear one thing today from someone who said that basically the Lions were going to get the last chance to match the offer, but that Sue was always going to a state that had no state income tax. So the Lions' offer was going to have to be not only match whatever he got from, you know, a team in Florida or whatever, but that it was have to be after taxes. So
yeah,
there was no way that they were going to be able to do that.
And do you realize when that story came out that they had offered him whatever? And that story came out after everyone had reported that he had agreed to the deal. It's almost like they purposely gave him something just below what he was offered and then just kind of make them seem like the oh, man, we tried in the end, you know, which is – I don't doubt their effort. But they never – the point is, guys, we never had to get to this stage. They had all the power. And they squandered it when they didn't call his bluff. And it's that simple. And everyone's like, well, he's going to a bad team, an average team, a mediocre team. That's irrelevant. I could care less who he goes to. It's all about taking care of your own business. And that's what
he's going
to
make them a much better team. I mean,
okay, well, fine, but it doesn't affect them.
They're going to be fine.
Detroit fans.
I think Ndamukong Suh's going
to. He's not exactly leaving the Patriots. He's leaving the most inept franchise in sports history. Let me ask you this question, Jay, because I know Spiro's answer because he's only, what, 27? So he hasn't been completely fried by this organization. But if the Lions ever did win a Super Bowl, what's that?
His bitterness comes out in Michigan State, which I love. I'm a Michigan State guy, too. So.
If the Lions ever did win a Super Bowl at this point, would it really even be enough for all we put up with for the first 40 years of my life? The answer to me is no. At some point, you know, if your spouse mentally abuses you, if your spouse beats you, if your spouse cheats on you, after a certain point, if this goes on for 20, 25 years, Your nerves get fried, and no matter what happens, whatever that person does to you, it's never going to make up for what preceded it. And that is where I am at the Lions. If the Lions won a Super Bowl in the next 5 years, I could not have the same joy that I would have from the other three Detroit sports teams.
Wow. I find that easy to believe, but at the same time, you know, that's what we play for. I mean, that's what you're playing for. And, you know, like, I've never understood of being the idea of being fiscally conservative cap-wise when you're going for a championship. Like, you, everyone knows when you go for a championship and you don't get it, and if you're cap strapped, everyone knows that each run has a period when that window closes, and people can respect you for going. Like, there's no point in being fiscally conservative like this franchise has tried to be when you only have one win in 57 years. You know, you have to keep going for it every
year.
Well,
they haven't been financially conservative. Yeah. The last few years, they've been robbing Peter to pay Paul, and it hasn't paid off at all. I mean, you know, they can touch anyone else's contract. But to lose Sue in this way, when if you just would have not touched his contract, if you never would have restructured, there's no way he leaves, and because of his
age, and they would have picked up easily. Yeah, and I'm not saying, like, one restructuring is fine, but when they do two or three, that's harmful to everybody. And the Steelers are realizing this with Ben Roethlisberger, just like the Cardinals realized it with Larry Fitzgerald a few years ago. One is fine, but you got to keep moving these around. You can't put yourself, and I'm sure somebody in the franchise said, hey, do you realize in 2015 we're going to have to do $26.7 million? I would have loved to have known what Luan and Mayhew's reaction was the first time someone brought that up, because it's just amazing. And, you know, it's different for me. Like, I want them to win, but, you know, I've been beaten down by the fact that it's not going to happen. So if they were to win a title for my dad, I know my dad could be one of those Red Sox fans when they won the World Series where he could say, man, I can die in peace now. I'm okay with this. And, you know, the Spartans, Michigan State won the Rose Bowl last year. I'm at the point now in my life where anything they do from this point forward, at least for the next 10 years, I'm absolutely okay with it because we beat Stanford in the Rose Bowl. That's how just like easy to please I am, you know?
And I agree, and that's what I've emphasized really when Moss goes off the rails with the Red Wings, and I think Moss has since sort of backtracked a little bit in saying that that organization doesn't owe us anything. I am 15 years younger than Moss, so I don't know where I'll be in 15 years with the Lions, but there's no question that would be the most gratifying of any of the four teams that could win a title. Moss and I just
okay, but
stand
imagine
in 15 there.
More years of this misery, of things like this occurring that happened with Sue. Just imagine 15 more years. It would be, 2030, and it's still the same, and nothing has changed. Do you think you'd be maybe a little more jaded and frustrated to the point where nothing that they could do could ever make it right?
Think about
15 more of this.
I'd certainly be jaded along the way. I don't know if when they raise the Lombardi Trophy, if I'll really give a crap about any of that stuff. I mean, it's, you know, I don't know. I can't answer that. That's a tough question. But
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think Ndamukong Suh is going to need a larger mason jar for all his used condoms with all that South Beach tail down there.
Well, that's a whole other thing. I will say this, though. It just dawned on me. Jeff said 2030. Do you realize Christmas Eve of 2000 was when did Herman drop that pass against the Bears and then Paul Ettinger hit the 52-yard field goal? What would life be like for the Lions if they had won that game? They would have gotten the playoffs. I believe they would have played the Saints in the wild card round. Gary Moeller, okay, he was a short-termer, but he would have kept his job. Matt Millen never gets hired. Maybe I never get hired by the Lions. Like, it's amazing to think, and I know Sean Bleasian plays this game all the time. If Herman catches that ball, they win that game. If Ettinger doesn't hit the 52-yarder, they win that game. How different is this franchise's course over the next 15 years?
Well, forget that for a second. Forget that for a second. I've always said that if you could change one thing in Detroit sports history in your lifetime, and it wasn't, you know, giving Richard Gnida a Red Bull the night that he crashed that limo or something like that.
Sure.
If it was something really
just for you guys.
Yep. Right. If it was just sports related, it's a no-brainer for me. It's drafting Randy Moss instead of Terry Fair. You make that one move, the history of that franchise is so altered. I mean, that little pebble in a lake, that would – just think about it. There's no way Barry retires if they draft Randy Moss that year. There's no freaking way. They would probably have one of the best offenses in the history of the sport. Millen never happens. That one move, just give me that. Just go
in the late 90s, Lions had pretty decent defenses,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, they were. They were good. Do you realize in 97, that was your no, Moss was 98. Terry Fair was taken, obviously, everyone knows that. The thing that blew my mind about that draft is that not that they passed on Moss, because if you want to pass on him with the character concerns, I'm all for that. But in round two, they took Jermaine Crowell, and Bobby Ross had the cojones to say in the press conference, when someone asked about Randy Moss, he said, "We liked Randy Moss, but he was our number two receiver behind Crowell." I wanted to just throw, like, whatever I could at, like, go Elvis on my TV and just, like, shoot the TV right there, because that was the most ridiculous logic I ever heard. If you don't want to draft him, fine, but don't tell me that Crowell was ranked ahead of him. That's the most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard, you know.
And we all wanted Moss at the time. I mean, I was 11 years old and I wanted him.
Moss wanted to go there, too. Somebody asked him before the draft where he would play, and he said he would love to go to the Steelers or the Lions because it was closest to his mom, and he would have been absolutely okay with that. You know,
can you imagine Barry Sanders and Randy Moss on this team? I mean, it is the most upsetting Detroit sports screw up. There's nothing even close, because we'd have gotten another probably 4 or 5 years out of Barry, which would have been enough. Even if they don't win a title, just watching Barry for another few more years would have been worth it by itself.
To me, that was the worst draft decision in history, because, of course, someone like Darko is a bigger bust than Terry Fair, but the decision.
Sure.
Pistons won a title 10 months later, 8 months later, whatever it was. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, it didn't have these damaging implications. So I totally agree with you. I would say Constantine off, but since you took that off the board, having Moss and Barry Sanders, I think Sanders stays at least two more seasons. That those late 90s, Lions defenses were very good with Ellis and Porche and Boyd. That would have been such a fun team to watch, and we were cheated out of something that was really special. And that is not hindsight. Most Lions fans were clamoring. Moss was the fan pick. That's who the Lions fans as a whole wanted.
Let me ask you a question.
Rush of the early 80s was good. Real quick, you guys should make a tournament from that. Best, if you could change one Detroit sports moment, I'm sure you could easily come out for 64 out of that one. You know, that's insane.
Okay.
That's a good idea.
All right, let me ask you this. You know that how my feeling on sports teams having their own website, and obviously you were a part of that.
It's a necessary imperative. It's
the beginning. Here's the thing, and here's my problem. If the Lions want to employ a Tim 20-man, if the Pistons want someone like Keith Langlois, call it what it is. It's public relations. It's not journalism. That is my issue with it. They try to act like it is. They have journalistic integrity. They don't. Where is Tim 20-man's office in relation in Allen Park to Martin Mayhew's?
I'm guessing it's right down the hall. So, you know.
Right. It's a joke. And for them to act, you know, he goes around calling himself a Lions insider. They actually interview him on these sports shows when there's Lion breaking news, and they have him on like he's an employee of the team. Where did your check come from when you were an employee of the Lions? Who wrote your check?
It was from Matt Millen. Yes, Matt Millen signed it. And it's a
Matt Millen actually literally signed your check?
Well, it was a scam. But I was 30 years old. Like, I was 30 years old. That wasn't my dream. Like, I greatly appreciate the.
No, I'm not blaming you. Everyone's got to make a living. But I doubt that you had any delusions that you were anything but basically someone in public relations for the Detroit Lions.
No, in fact, I'll tell you this. I know you're a big Howard Stern fan. You know, in the movie, the Howard, whatever, Private Parts. It's called. Yeah. You know, the beginning of the movie when he has his fart man moment where he realizes that life sucks because he has to do something? When I was covering the Lions, this is a true story, and it was my fart man moment. It was 05, the summertime, and the movie, The Longest Yard remake, had come out. And they sent me down there to get the player's reaction of the movie coming out. And I was like, did not want to do it. I just like, it's a total pandering and it's PR and all this stuff. And I was sitting there outside the theater and Steve Mariucci came out and I had a good relationship with Mooch. He sees me and sees that I'm holding a microphone and he just gave me the look like he had so much pity for me at the time because he knew that I was just there to ask him, what did you think of a horrible movie? And it was, I just felt like, I felt so small, and I told my parents after that. I go, I'm Fartman. I am Howard Stern right there. That because they respected me all that time as a writer until that moment when they see me sticking a microphone in their face of the second they walk out of a really bad movie. It was horrible for me, you know.
Well, Tim Twentyman was so happy to pass along the company line of we're confident we'll re-sign Sue. This is what we've been hearing from him for the last several months, even in the last few weeks preceding free agency. And you look at his Twitter timeline since the news broke, Sue to Dolphins, there's only one reference to it, and it says that Miami came at him with an incredible offer. I mean, that there was no other reference to anything. So, you know, he has no problem fluffing Juan and Mayhew's confidence and telling the public, calm down, take a breath, we're going to get this done. And then when it hits the fan, he goes on there and says, hey, Miami made one hell of an offer. I mean, you know, it's a sham. He's not a journalist. I think most people understand
thing.
That.
And you know what? And Jason Beck, he writes for MLB. I don't find him to be offensive. You know what you're getting, but I don't find him to be a big cheerleader any different than Chris Iatt or any other Tigers beat writers. Lang Loy, I don't know. I don't get offended by that. There's a guy who does it for the Wings. It's just, here's my problem with 20 Men. And I was told by people at the Detroit News, if I went back and looked at the archives of his articles, that he used to be very critical of the Lions. And then when there was discussion started that they wanted him to come over and take that job, everything changed. And all of a sudden there was flowery pieces about the team for a few months before he actually took the job. And to me, that's absolute despicable behavior. I understand everyone has to make a living. Everyone has to feed their family. But the way he goes about it, that person goes about that job and how he got that job and how he, you know, acts like he is some independent force, you are not. You are a professional hack. That is all you are.
You guys would have I just shudder to think what I would be like if I were my age right now and I was doing that job, because you guys would have the same opinion about me, because it's one of those things where you have to do it. It's one of those things where, but you know, I really don't have anything bad to say about the Lions, anybody that works here personally. But at the same time, there is an understanding that you have to do what makes them look the best. And you have to put them in a positive light all the time, and that's fine. Like, the Atlanta Falcons here in Atlanta do it the same way, and it's just
Who works for the team?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I get along with the guy, too. In fact, I had a story idea for him with the head coach, Dan Quinn, and he stole the idea from me, so I need to go punch him the next time I see him, because I told him that I was going to do this huge feature on the coach during the summertime, and he stole the idea. But, you know, it's one of those things where everyone has it, and you just kind of have to let it roll off your back with these guys sometimes. Like, some people, like, for franchises, like, there was a guy, Jeff Mosher, he used to write for the Eagles. Jeff Spadaro, whatever. This guy would wear, like, funny hats on the sidelines during preseason games. Like, some of these guys are clowns, and some of these guys take their jobs really seriously. So you can't paint them all in the same light. Just know that all of them are getting their paychecks from ownership, which isn't the worst thing in the world either. It's a job, and there's nobility in all work. You just can't paint yourself as
If you're just going to write straight news pieces, but when you start doing features and opinion pieces, you've got no credibility. It's just,
is there anything funnier than when Tim Twentyman does his draft grade column and gives the Lions an A-minus or better every year? I mean, that's the kind of stuff we're talking about, Jay. We're not criticizing someone for working for the team and having a slight positive.
I know.
The guy writes commentary. That's the issue. If he wants to present news in a favorable light, that is what it is. I think, you know, that's what Moss is saying Jason Beck does. Jason Beck doesn't write a grades column, to my knowledge, not that I've ever seen in his 15 years working for Tigers.com. I mean, that's the issue. Tim Twentyman writes editorials as if he were an independent journalist, and it's a joke. You know, it's an insult to the intelligence of the reader.
No one ever asked me to write an opinion piece for the Lions. And they hated me. Frankly, some of the, like, people like Barnard at the time, they didn't like me because they thought I was too objective. And
what about Bill Keenis?
I'm not going to comment on Keenis. You know, like, you know, I'll leave it at that, you know.
You're not going to comment on
that. You guys think, Ndamukong Suh is greedy and selfish for going to Miami, like Mitch Albom does?
You're not going to ever hear me say anything about Bill Keenis, positive, negative, and we'll just leave it at that. Like, he is one of those people where
he can just move on. Let's switch gears here. Let's get you up the hot seat. Let's talk about the DSR Fantasy Baseball League, which is going to take place, March
22nd
at the Baronial Mansion in Bloomfield Hills. I don't know how much Jay followed this last year when you bought Jose Canseco for the league to draft.
I'm aware of that, yes.
You're aware of that. Okay, so now we're 2 weeks away, less than 2 weeks away, and Spiro has bought someone else. We don't know who it is. Nobody will know until the cloak is taken off sometime around noon on the 22nd. Why don't you ask Spiro a few questions about going about this and how much it costs.
Are you talking to me? You want me to ask questions?
Ask him a few questions about who this higher power is going to be this year. Maybe you can get out.
If my recollection about Jose is that this is something Jose did annually. Like, it's not just a one-time thing. He will do this for a bunch of people, right? So I assume that you scoped out a guy that does this regularly. So it's probably a guy who has name value still, but you wouldn't, like, care about him if you saw him, you know, crossing the street or something like that.
Back up a second. Where did you get this impression about Canseco? He told us it was the first baseball league he'd ever done.
Really? Oh, come on.
Yeah.
This man, didn't he have, like, before the web starting in Twitter and all that stuff, he had, like, a 900 line where he would tell you what he was doing that day. Like, if he went to the grocery
and he had
store,
a thing where you could hang out at his house for, you know, a certain amount of money. I don't remember what it was. But I think we were his first
fantasy baseball draft, but you could pay him for appearances, which you can basically pay anyone for an appearance. I mean, hell, you could, if you had $1 million, you can get, I think, Aerosmith to play your bar mitzvah. But
you can get Bill Clinton to show up. You know, I mean, anyone's available, technically.
Everyone's got their price.
No,
so,
like, I'm just curious to know, like, what, this is amazing that you guys do this. And the fact that you can find somebody, I'm guessing it's not local, I'm guessing it's somebody national, is that correct?
I'm not going to comment on that. The only hint that I have given is that it is a man.
It is not
a woman.
Okay.
Oh, that's great.
That's the only hint you're going to get. And I mean, unless you consider the fact that your minds are going to be blown as a hint. But
A theory that it's Pete Rose.
Now, that would make sense because he's trying to ingratiate himself back into baseball's good graces. So why not go hang out with a bunch of guys at Bloomfield Hills? That makes sense, you know?
I don't know. If he wants to get in baseball's good graces and have any integrity, hanging out in our league is probably not a good option for him.
No.
Let's see. Maybe it's a former Tiger. You know, I almost got Milt Wilcox killed. In 98, we were at Old Shillelagh waiting in line on St. Paddy's Day. And I believe it was 98, and it was pouring rain, and Milt Wilcox was walking across the street in a trench coat. And I just started screaming Milt, like, and I was probably drinking or something like that. And a car almost killed him, and I would have been responsible for Milt Wilcox dying.
If it's Milt Wilcox, 10 guys are going to walk out when they see that it's him.
Terry Foster thinks Milt Wilcox was the best catcher in Tigers history.
Okay, I'm pretty sure that's a Dave Bergman reference. That's funny. That's funny.
So you're working down there for Fox Sports. Are you still doing fantasy stuff?
Yeah, but I'm Fox Sports South, just like we have for Detroit. But I do, like, national pieces for Big Fox, and I'm the national fantasy writer for Fox. So what I do, I'm just based here, and obviously we do a lot of stuff for South. We are the most profitable of the Fox Sports, you know, the region. So I can do a lot. It's not just covering Detroit, which is, you know, would be a great job, you know, if I still live there. But at the same time, we have a lot more freedom to do stuff down here in Atlanta than those guys have in Detroit.
Okay, so if you're the national fantasy writer for Fox Sports, if Spiro pulls off someone bigger than Jose Canseco, is there going to be an article about it on Fox Sports?
Probably not. But I do have my own blog, like the Fantasy Fox blog, so I'd be more than happy to do it, but I'm pretty sure Big
Fox
only likes...
We get someone huge, like,
well,
minds
yeah,
are
if
blown.
He, and he's got to do something weird. See, like, Big Fox loves, like, stories of man bites dog stories. They love that stuff. So if you give me something good and the guy actually does something interesting, then I guarantee you it.
I think the fact that a fantasy league has Jose Canseco 1 year, and the next year if someone's bigger than Jose Canseco, I think this is kind of an anomaly. I don't think there's a lot of fantasy sports leagues that go and pay, like, $5,000 for someone to be – I don't know. I think there's some – I think it would be interesting to a national audience if we get someone bigger than Jose.
You know, Neil Patrick is – Neil Patrick Harris's cameo in White Castle movies. If you had Tony Phillips come over and do some of that stuff, maybe that would be something Big Fox would like, you know?
Okay, I just think that it's going to be in the police blotter because there's going to be brain matter all over the walls when heads explode upon the reveal. That's all I'm going to say.
Well,
you actually
gave another hint. You said that the person who is going to be the higher power, I have some sort of beef with, or there will be some sort of confrontation between me and the higher power
that
I will be engaging the higher power.
I'm not going to comment any further on that hint.
But you did say that, correct?
I did.
See, I'm telling you, this is something that you
really
need to
write about. I had to teach you a lesson that you would never, ever forget. Like Vince McMahon said to Stone Cold Steve Austin, which was the origin of this whole bit.
Yeah, it was. All right,
if you
got anything else?
Is Paul Orndorff still alive? Maybe if you had him.
No, he's dead.
His
heart exploded.
Really?
We got a couple minutes left. You want to touch on Mitch Albom real quick, Spiro?
Yeah, I do.
I
guess
he's a big Mitch Albom fan.
Well, you know, Mitch Albom, as I pointed out in the Detroit Sports Rag, actually, this is the Darko Sports Rag that this was addressed. I pointed out that Mitch Albom condemned Ndamukong Suh's decision to bolt for Miami on the basis of 2 points. One, he was greedy, and two, he was selfish. And essentially selfish, alluding to the fact that it was a money grab. Now, Mitch Albom will do anything for a dollar and has sold his soul countless times for the almighty buck. And there's no one in the state of Michigan with a bigger ego than Mitch Albom. So he writes an entire, basically, I phrase it as a hit piece on Ndamukong Suh, saying good riddance, the fans shouldn't even be sad that he's gone. That was sort of the crux of the argument, that because Suh is arrogant and selfish and has this gigantic ego, therefore the Lions fans shouldn't care about his absence. Now, that's always been a flawed argument to begin with. People that thought Sergei Fedorov was arrogant or selfish or whatever, first of all, we know that's not true, but whether the guy's arrogant or not, you're losing a significant piece from your team. So I think that's a flawed argument to begin with. But when you look at the utter hypocrisy of Mitch Albom putting somebody else on blast for having a big ego, it's laughable. It's almost like you can't believe that he's even serious.
There's no one less self-aware in the world. Let's just talk about Mitch Albom for a second, the guy who, you know, who's ripping him for taking the money and ripping Suh for being selfish and greedy. This is a man who crossed the picket line when the newspapers were on strike. This is a man who, when one of his books came out, the Free Press was going to run it wasn't a puff piece on it. It was kind of a semi-critical review, I believe, and he crushed it. He threw a fit and said that was an insult to him that they were going to run a review of his book that wasn't glowing. This is a guy who is a walking, talking, breathing conflict of interest. His charity just took a donation of $1 million from the Detroit Lions starting quarterback. I mean, can you imagine if Stafford somehow left town? What do you think he would have got the same treatment as Suh, considering they're basically in business together? I don't care if it's a nonprofit or not. You know, we could go on and on about Mitch Albom, his hypocrisies, and, you know, he's taking a paycheck basically and being forced at gunpoint to write a certain amount of articles. And because of that, he, you know, he gives us Dr. Football in the last 2 months of the year because it only takes 5 minutes to write. And this guy is going to say that Sue is greedy? Where's this guy ever turned down money?
And it's not just the fact that he went after Sue. He explicitly in the column absolves the front office. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but there's a line in the middle of that column that says, if you're trying to blame the Detroit Lions front office, make sure you save some of that blame for Ndamukong Suh. I mean, he says it right in the column. He is imploring the reader to lay blame on Ndamukong Suh for going to South Beach for more money and what I would say is a better situation all around, and not to mention no state income tax. I mean, he's flat out telling you to blame Suh for this decision. It's inexplicable. There's no rationale behind it. You can think the guy's a jerk. It's not like you and I think. He's one of your most hated Detroit athletes of all time, Moss. So it's not like we're saying the guy's great as a person. We think he's kind of a piece of shit too. But you don't blame him for this decision. This was a good decision that, frankly, I would have made too. I would take more money, no state income tax, and living in South Beach over less money, high state income tax, and living in Detroit or Royal Oak or wherever. This is a decision that all of these critics of this move would make, frankly. And it's incredible to see the fan base erupt. And the anger is not directed towards where it should be. It's completely misdirected towards the player, and that is further perpetuated by Mitch Albom's article and several other commentaries from Tom Mazzaway, Scott Anderson, where the rallying cry is, even on billboards we're seeing it, screwed with the dollar sign for the S and the UH for Sue. The reaction of this town, I feel like I deserve a winner, but I'm not sure the city deserves a winner when Ndamukong Suh does something that any of them would do, almost anyone would do, and the hate is on him and not the front office for allowing it to reach this point. Where's the billboard calling out Tom Wand and Martin Mayhew? It's not there. It's calling out the player for exercising his free agent rights.
Okay, got any Mitch Albom stories, Jay?
None that I can say here. How about that?
No. Rats. All right. Well, I appreciate you joining us and sharing your thoughts at a more national and behind the scenes type of level. Justin, we'll see you in 13 days for the higher power.
The last draft at the Baronial. We'll be moving to Rochester in the new residence for next year's draft.
I will be stalking the Townsend on Saturday night.
We're going out to dinner Saturday night, but I'm
going
to try to get back really late.
I will be stalking Bella Piatti. I would not go to Jasper's dad's restaurant if you want to keep the higher power a secret from me. I've already told Melissa we're dining there that night.
Okay.
Wait, you're going to the Townsend? Is Ozzie Guillen the higher power?
The higher power is the fat kid that Miguel Cabrera shamed. Would that be a great higher power if you found that kid?
No, that'll be for 2016.
Jay, on top of the fact that he's paying this person to fly in, probably first class, and whatever their appearance fee is, he's also putting him up to Townsend. I mean, this has got to be over under 38.50. I'm going way over.
So
I'm
not commenting on the finances.
The kid Justin Henry from Tiger Town, the movie with Roy Scheider from the 80s?
No, okay.
That'd be good.
If I had my druthers, it would be Kurt Menchie.
Why won't you tell us how much it costs? Why?
Well, for one, that's a huge hint. But it's a huge hint.
It's over $3,500 total, including
I'm not
airfare,
commenting.
Hotel. Come on, just give me that. Is it over $3,500?
No comment.
ESR is the place of honesty in Detroit sports, and you are hiding from the answer. This is something I'd expect from Mike Valente and Terry Foster. Not you, Justin. Is it over or under 3,500? Come on.
13 days. Much will be understood that is not understood right now.
All right. Well, I thank you guys for joining us. I hope everyone out there had a good time. And, maybe by the year 2072, we'll have another playoff win for the Detroit Lions.
Thanks, Jay.
Have a good evening. Thanks a lot, Jay.
Thanks,
Fox Sports Atlanta. You can read him there nationally. And what's your blog?
Well, it's the Fantasy Fox blog, but you can get me at Twitter, ATL underscore J Clemens. So.
ATL underscore J Clemens. Yep. Do you think you'll have any feedback from the Lions organization for appearing with the Antichrist?
I'm out of their shackles. I'm allowed to say whatever. And if you go back, I don't think I've said anything bad that's not in bounds. We have different ways of attacking this, and I think I've, you asked me to come on, and here we are. So
I appreciate it. We will talk soon. Good night, everybody.
All right. Good night. Okay.